there's probably a little bit too much fuss made about scores.
I think I'm a farmer deep down at heart. I wanted a family endeavor.
It's not about what someone else says. It's not about what rating it got. It's about what you enjoy drinking.
Wine to start with is something that is social.
It's about networking. It's about calling up people and ask for advice. And everybody's willing to help out.
Consumer wants something that's uncomplicated about wine. Why do you want one more thing to worry about?
I would trade this for nothing. It is my life and it is my dream.
You know, you only get to make one wine a year. It's not very much. I've been making wine most of my adult life, you know. It's only 35 Cabernets. I don't think that's a lot. I'm up for more.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle and welcome to our October podcast featuring Kendall Hoxie of Napa Wine Company. This podcast is brought to you by Waterford Wine. Find them on the web at waterfordwine.com.
The Napa Wine Company Tasting Room is, simply put, a powerhouse of wine labels. And that's because the Napa Wine Company is also a custom crush facility. To name a few, Crocker & Star, Pallmeyer, Elizabeth Rose, Bridesmaid, Ghost Block, Nova Wines, Volker Eisler, and more. Kendall Hoxie has grown up in the business and does bring a different perspective to wine, but seems to live the same passion as everyone else in this business.
Let's start, shall we?
Okay.
How you doing, Kendall? Nice to see you again.
Oh, thank you. Good to see you as well.
And for our listeners, we met Kendall at the Next Generation...
Premier event.
At the premier event, right.
Yeah.
And that was back in February.
It was.
And so your wine label is called Elizabeth Rose.
Yes.
And tell me about what you're making right now.
Well, currently we're actually going through a relaunching. So what it originally had started as was a rosé, a Sauvignon Blanc, a Pinot Blanc, and a Pinot Noir. We got rid of the Pinot Blanc since that seemed to be a little bit of a non-common varietal. And now we're changing it all to still a rosé, a Chardonnay, Merlot, and a Pinot Noir. So that'll be relaunching in March 2012.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming, and I didn't get to see or try the Pinot Blanc, that is obviously a white.
Yes.
Just not left on the skins as long, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it is a white varietal, but usually you pair it with fish. I know, for instance, Robert Foley makes a nice Pinot Blanc. So some people still do it, but we just found it wasn't selling quite as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we always enjoyed it.
Well, that's good. You gotta like it too.
Oh, yeah. I was gonna say we're the ones making it and probably drinking more of it.
Well, when you make something, I'd like to think it's something that you know, you make it for a reason, right? It's something that influenced you or something that turned you on at another winery or another part of the world or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's the fun part about this is that you always think you love something better, but then you discover something new and, oh, this is great.
So you'd be making 40 different wines if you possibly could, right?
Probably. I don't know if we've got the money for that.
So what is your output right now?
Our output is probably about 3,000 cases. Potentially, we'd love to be at 5,000 in 10 years, maybe even 10,000. But we are part of a portfolio. So the other two labels that are with us are Ghost Block and Oakville Winery. And those are all reds with also a 400-case Sauvignon Blanc with Ghost Block that is made from Elizabeth Rose Sauvignon Blanc, but Sir Lead. So 9 months more on in barrels. So it's a much rounder mouthfeel to it. So it's a really fun Sauvignon Blanc that way.
Okay, so what is your official title with the company?
I'm a compliance manager, so I have the very non-romantic role within the winery of taking care of taxes and COLAs and making sure basically everybody's compliant with the TTB, as well as making sure all of our clients, because we are a custom crush facility, so that they are knowing their rights, kind of knowing how their billing works, so all those things. But it's a really good place to start when you're young and knowing, just wanting to know the business side of it all, because at least that's where I feel it's a new potential venue for young entrepreneurs.
So really, you're the one who makes it all legit.
Supposedly.
As often as you possibly can, when it's within your knowledge.
Yes, that's always the key. Is sometimes, you know, I'll get a call from somebody else and saying, oh, did you hear about this new law? Oh, no.
I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
How do you keep on? I mean, you'd literally have to have a lawyer on your sleeve.
Pretty much, yeah. And because, at least with me, I only handle the production compliance. So that makes a big difference, too, because I'm not handling any of the interstate rules. So whenever people have questions, well, I want to ship to Pennsylvania. Well, good luck. Go talk to the government of Pennsylvania.
I hear all kinds of stories about winemakers telling me about how they're paying taxes in other states. And yes. I know what it's like for me to pay taxes in my state, so it's very complicated.
Yeah.
And of course, a lot of them are forcing you now to go online.
Yes.
And I don't mean they're not asking you, they're forcing you to go online. Not that that's the worst thing in the world, but it certainly is one more thing to your pile.
It is, but I mean, it's kind of nice because online will help you. You don't have to worry about when are they calling me back, you know, when are their working hours. It makes it a big difference. So at least you always know the internet should be working.
Sure, right. Should be.
Yes, keyword.
All right, now let's talk about, we're here at the Napa Wine Company, and this is a tasting facility for different labels, mm-hmm. different brands. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people that visit here might be a little bit confused exactly how that works. So why don't you tell us, number one, I guess, about the ownership, and number two is who is in your tasting room.
No worries. It is kind of a confusing model, but the way that we work is that the Palisa family, although all the Palisas have now died out, so it's the Hoxie, Harris, and Dickinson, and Jacoby that are all together. They're the family members from Andrew Palisa, who started all of this. So we were always growers back in 1904. That's when we started. And then in 93, my father decided that, well, let's try a custom crush facility, because they weren't very popular back then. It was kind of a new concept. So the custom crush facility, we have 26 alternating proprietors. We call them APs. So they have the opportunity to use their own winemaker, use the barrels, use the tanks, do everything that they would want to do in their own space without putting out the capital for their own winery. So it's a pretty nice way that way. My dad always talks about it as a think tank, kind of grooming potential people to build their own wineries. So people that have gone on have been Groth, Madrigal, and I can go on and on. Pallmeyer, you know, is a huge label, but they have stayed with us pretty much from the beginning. They just like having their own place to do it at, so they can focus on other avenues that way. And then so, you know, they have the opportunity then when they bottle with us to say produced and bottled at Pallmeyer Labels, Oakville, California. And when you're an AP, you also have the opportunity to be in our tasting room. So that will be 26 people as well. So Eponymous, Blackbird, Lamborn, Mason, and I can go on and on. There's so many great people that are in our tasting room and so many great wines. And that's what makes our tasting room so unique, because we'll have all the way from Sauvignon Blanc to Botrytis and then to the heavy cabs. So that makes it fun, because if you come in with your whole group and you all have different tastes in wines, it's all right there.
It is pretty interesting when people come in, because just like you say, you're talking about Pallmeyer, which is a very, very well-known high-end brand. You have Blackbird. Then you also have some stuff that everyday people can buy in every situation, mm-hmm. which is pretty cool. Would it be fair to call these labels investors, or is that not how it works?
I wouldn't necessarily call them investors. I mean, they certainly, the people that started with us in the beginning have invested in this for us, because it was such a gamble back then. I don't even think that they really knew what they were getting into at the time. But now you have people like Miner, Laird, The Ranch. It's really caught on, and people have found that this is the great way to start out if you really want to be serious about making your own wines. And especially because you, say for instance, we'll have winemakers here that have dozens of clients. Ann Vauder is one that I can think of who comes in for multiple clients. Mm-hmm. You know, she's a young and she's a great winemaker too, so I can see her going great places. And there's multiple others as well. And Randy Mason, he was our first general manager. I mean, look at where his labels have gone, you know, Pomelo and Mason. He's pretty much well known as a great Sauvignon Blanc winemaker.
So I see a lot of pride when you talk about this. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And what year did it open again?
93.
So you're talking about the 26 labels that you have now. Now, you come to a point where maybe one of them pulls away, they're going to do their own thing, or a couple of them do that. Mm-hmm. Does that create an availability? Do you like to keep it at 26? Does it become 23 at one time? I mean, how does that work?
Well, the government set the 26 limit, for us at least. So we'll always have 26 APs.
Why 26?
Who knows? That would be a great question, but sometimes I don't even want to know how they connect the dots.
Somewhere in this world, there is a box that has a dartboard in it with a dart stuck to the number 26.
Exactly. But, you know, the other thing we have is that with our personal bond is we have our own number for the wines that my family will make. But then number 9, which is the bonded winery facility, which is the only single-digit winery facility in California still working today, people can bottle under that. So they'll produce it at another facility, but they'll bring it in to be bottled. So they can say vinted and bottled here. So all these different things. So Tiedemann will do that, and multiple other people.
So you have your own bottling facility here, then? You don't use the trucks? Okay.
Yeah. We have maybe used a bottling truck three times, you know, during, and that's when we had lots of bottling.
But it gets heavy.
Yeah. So those are usually in high summer, you know, just before harvest. But yeah, we have two lines. So line one will be for the faster, larger orders. And then both lines are outfitted to do screw cap as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. So my dad was a big proponent. He always really appreciated that. So there's a picture of him with screw caps all on his fingers and things like that.
Okay, we're going to have to come back to that particular subject.
Okay.
What makes me curious about your operation here is, let's say one of these 26 steps away and they go on to bigger things, mm-hmm. not necessarily better, but bigger things, do it all on their own. And I come along and I'm a cab guy and maybe I have leases and I want to go ahead and start this up. Mm-hmm. Number one is, how would that happen if a spot opened up? And number two, I'm kind of curious, what kind of a cost would somebody be looking at? I don't know if that's a realistic question.
Usually you would go talk to the general manager, since he pretty much says who can be in here, and he'll find if it's a good working relationship, depending on how many barrels you have. And then also you'd have to come to us with your bond and everything as well, like that, because when you become an AP, you legally have your own bond. So, and the way TTB will look at it pretty much is that if they see you are your own bonded winery premise, in a way they look at your little area in our winery as your space. So there's so many legalities with all that. So I won't bore you to death with it all, but at least that's the way. So in a way they see it as kind of, you know, your property that way. Renting space can be from 1,000 to 2, maybe even a little bit less. Depends on how much you have.
Per month, single point, I mean.
Per month.
Okay.
Because you also, I mean, will, at least part of my job is I will do all of your state excise taxes and your federal excise taxes. Mm-hmm. Then there's other taxes that people can handle. So I think the thing that people forget is just how expensive this really is.
I don't think people really want to look at that. I think they sort of, like anything else, they can go ahead and just wake up one morning, put their feet in their bunny slippers and become a winemaker, right?
Yeah.
Because it's very easy to do, of course.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Anybody could do it.
Pretty much.
Right. So when they go about this, in terms of their output strictly based on whatever they may come to you with, is there, you have a limit, you said, of how many wine labels you can have. Is there a limit to how much they can come to you with?
No, I have clients that have multiple labels, and they're called DBAs or FBNSs, so fictitious business names. So at least what their legal name, what they pay all their taxes through, and then they can have numerous names.
Just to be clear enough from a legal point of view, like a DBA doing business as, so we say fictitious, these aren't fronts. More like, what would you call the boutique label type thing, right?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, it is a legal term. The Napa County clerk does say FBNSs.
Okay.
So, you know, it wouldn't be a front, but I mean, there's names like Catty Wampus or things like that. So people have very interesting names, things like that.
Well, from what I understand, every name was taken up. That's what I've heard out there. You know, there's really not too many names left.
There aren't, but the spellings will astound you.
Ah, I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. How many types of facilities are there like the Napa Wine Company around? I mean, we've all heard of Crush Pad. I don't know if that falls in the same category. I've always had the impression, and I'm sorry I'm interrupting the question.
No.
That Crush Pad was more for someone like me, an average Joe, versus somebody who's more professional with a background like your family has.
I would agree with that. We used to have a program here where we would take about 10 tons of cab or some other varietal that we had extra of, and we would have a garagiste program. So people would drive up with their half-ton bin, and then after it had been sorted and everything like that, and they would take it and they would make their own wine at their home. So it was kind of a fun little project. And actually, I think all of them were medical doctors in Southern California.
Interesting.
So I always thought that was very intriguing because, I mean, maybe it was just something that they were doing in their off time, although I don't know how much off time doctors have.
Well, you gotta have a hobby, right?
I suppose. So maybe after surgery, I could use a bottle of my cab right now.
Yeah, well, and hopefully after surgery.
Yes.
Can you explain the word? I've heard it before, and I've talked with a couple of other people, but can you explain the word garagiste for our listeners?
Yeah, so the garagiste program had been, I believe it's the term that was used pretty much right during and after the Prohibition era, and because it would be used for people that were making wine in their garage, their basement, their bathtub, things like that. So I think it's just a term that's lingered on, but it's kind of fun to say in a way.
Oh, it's a very romantic term.
And it is.
And in fact, we interviewed some folks up in Sonoma who have a label called Cottergraph.
Okay.
And they started with Crush Pad, and actually they met and fell in love and went ahead and created their own label, and the rest is history, which is kind of neat.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. And I think that just more and more makes the point of how wine brings people together.
Absolutely.
So Tell me about the Elizabeth Rose wines that you're making right now.
Well, basically my favorite of the whole brand is the Syrah Rosé. And we'll also add in a little bit of Cinsault and Grenache. And I believe that's more of the Southern Rhone style. So to me, it just reminds you of all what a rosé should be. It's wonderful strawberry color. It's so enjoyable. And I mean, I enjoy it in the wintertime. Doesn't matter to me. But we'll do it with barbecue chicken and we'll have a watermelon salad. So it's a great wine. And then I'm really looking forward to trying our hand at Chardonnay as well. I tend to prefer more of the acidic, less oaked, so we're putting it on neutral oak actually right now.
And where are those grapes coming from?
Those grapes are coming from our Yonville property.
Okay.
And we have about, we have 1,000 acres altogether, but 635 of them are planted. Mm-hmm. And we have land in Oakville and Yonville. And that's where my great-grandfather had started all of our growing. And so all the Elizabeth Rose line is meant to be kind of a symbol, or well, not a symbol, but represent the Yonville AVA.
Let's talk about the rosé a little bit more. I just want to go a little deeper in this because rosé has become so popular among serious wine drinkers, not popular amongst everyday wine drinkers. Mm-hmm. I find that really interesting. I've talked to a number of winemakers who are focusing on it very much after the French model. Mm-hmm. But as we know, this is something you usually buy for relatively quick consumption.
Yes.
There is no aging possibility with a rosé. Is that correct?
There could be, but why? It's such an enjoyable one to drink immediately. And because, you know, you pick it so quickly and you're able to bottle it within the same year, potentially, and, you know, you want to drink it right off the shelves because, in a way, it just tastes better, to me at least. I have had some older rosés, and they still hold up quite well, but in a way, it's just so fresh and so fun, and when spring comes, you just want that freshness.
Sure. When spring eventually comes, yes.
Yes, exactly.
I've only allowed myself to be turned back onto rosé over the last couple of years. I really enjoyed it, the bottle I bought from you. Mm-hmm. What is the average temperature, proper temperature for a rosé? Everybody knows what, you know, whites should be at, and mm-hmm. most people know what good red should be at. But mm-hmm. rosé sometimes falls into a bit of a, I think, a black hole for some people. They're never sure, can I put that in my fridge? Can I keep it in my chiller? Mm-hmm. You know.
I mean, I do just store it in my refrigerator because, you know, if I'm going to serve it that night, I'll put it in about an hour or two before, just because it is chilled and it has a nice thing to it. I've seen people where they put ice into their rosé, but that's usually on 100-degree weather. So that's when they want it real chilled.
Ah, ice. Wow.
Yeah. But I really appreciate it because even I went on a trip to North Carolina a few years ago and we were trying muscadine wine. And I remember kind of having the same feelings. I was just like, what is this stuff? But my dad said something really interesting to me. Don't look down on anything else that's getting more people to drink wine.
I would agree with that.
And that really turned a light bulb on in my head. I was just like, you're exactly right. Because, you know, if it brings more people to the table and it's something that's less imposing to them and, you know, less scary, how great.
And yeah, it would be sort of like criticizing for anybody who loves a Cab or a Pinot to criticize White Zin because White Zin really did put wine back on the map again. So.
Yeah, and I mean, just my sister and I are, and all the other winery kids are so rare because we've just grown up and it's just part of our lives. You know, we never can remember a meal when it wasn't on the table that way. But for a lot of other kids, especially when I went to college in Pennsylvania, oh my God, you're drinking wine. You know, I only like sweet stuff. And I said, well, here, try this. And they would be amazed because they just had no experience with it. So in a way, I kind of realized I really need to remember that our experience is in the rarity.
It is a totally different experience, just like a few people I've already talked to where they families that raise their kids drinking wine at very young ages, mm-hmm. mostly to teach them responsibility and understand moderation in that, which is really a shame that we don't think that way in America.
That is quite true. It's so much of a European sensibility that it is just part of the meal. And I think that's why there can be some gray areas when it comes to wine producers and even with the government, because we see it as a beverage. It's not an alcoholic drink anyway, even though the alcohol levels are higher than they were a few years ago. But it is meant to be with food, and that it just brings so much more nuance to it that way.
I agree. What are your recommendations for food with rosé? What do you, you know, I think of something like a pizza, but I'll eat pizza with just about anything.
Oh, so. Yeah. Well, my dad does a great barbecue chicken. We'll put it in that new cooker, which is a big green egg. And so it caramelizes the barbecue sauce on it, which is quite good. And then my mom makes a watermelon salad where it has watercress, the watermelon, and then some red onions in it. And it's quite refreshing. But we've had it with pretty much everything. And that's why I love Syrah Rosé. I think it, you know, gives it where it could be with a heartier meat dish, but it can also be with softer things too.
really also you could do anything with it versus where you might be more limited because of the acid in a red with what you'd want to serve it with.
Yeah, and to me, you're only limited by what you don't think is possible.
Right. It is all about what you enjoy, not what other people tell you you should enjoy.
Yeah.
So we talked about briefly a moment ago or a while ago about screw caps. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing there's some strong opinions in your family about the differences between screw caps and corks.
Well, I'd say this probably streams from at least, you know, we've been CCOF approved since 1988, which is quite a while ago. California certified organic farmers. So that probably has colored our view to quite a bit of things because at least we didn't jump on the bandwagon. We were almost at the forefront of it. So when a new possibility of wine closures came about, you know, let's give it a try. So with the Elizabeth Rose line, that was kind of our way of seeing, like, let's see how this goes. Because we have had some bad luck when it came to corks. And, you know, we understand the whole romantic thing of opening the bottle of wine and storing it. And, you know, it's a whole show. And that's great with Cab because it's meant to be like that. You know, it's one of the kings of Napa. With Pinot Noir, it's one of the lighter reds. We feel that you could have a screw cap on it because Pinot, you don't necessarily have to store that much. And we're making our Pinot Noir as we want it to be something to be instantly enjoyed. It's elegant, but it's still something that can add grace to any other event. I mean, even if you were going on a hike one day, just pulled out your bottle of Pinot Noir, open it right up and have a glass.
That makes it a lot easier when you're traveling. You don't have to worry about the issues with what you carry with you.
Because I've had a few wine openers taken from me at customs.
It's a drag, isn't it? Yes, I've had that happen too.
Yes.
Obviously, so there's a lot of faith in this idea of having the screw cap. So
there are. And we'll do, I mean, the other two labels will do Oak Grove Winery and Ghost Block. They will be all cork, but the Elizabeth Rose maintains to stay screw cap.
I've asked a few people about this because for the whole time we've been doing Life Between the Vines, almost always I'll ask a winemaker about this concept between cork and cap. Mm-hmm. But a couple years ago, I saw this glass enclosure. Mm-hmm. And I've heard more and more people talk about it. I got one enologist who just went crazy about the concept, how much he loves it. So have you guys thought about it? What do you know about it?
I know Robert Sinsky does it. We had a bottle of his, I believe it was Pinot Blanc, actually. I think so. And we loved it. And we considered doing it when we were redesigning Elizabeth Rose. The problem would be is that it's so expensive to put the new machinery onto our bottling line. And the problem is because our bottling line is not only servicing our wines, it's servicing all the other clients. So that came into our decision to just stick with screw cap. But it's really fun. I think it would be really cool to do.
It seems to me to be the good compromise because there's a certain sexy feel to it, which mm-hmm. of course everybody likes the cork because it is the romantic, the sexy feel.
Yeah.
There's nothing fun about the sound of a cap on screen. That's if there's something to be done about that, I think that would help a lot.
Probably. And I see people as so innovative, so there probably is going to be something new coming along eventually as well, which would change too. It just comes down to we're still in a business, so we still have to make money, and
sure.
Unfortunately, those have to guide decisions.
So that's obviously not in your future, but do you think that's a good enclosure, I mean, from your experience or what you've seen about it?
Yeah, because I think it would still maintain, you know, would keep the wine. I don't think that there'd be a spoilage factor unless there was something wrong with it before it went into the bottle. So I think that would cut down on, you know, bad corks or things like that. Storing, I think, would be fine. I haven't seen the glass cap with reds, though, so I don't know. I've only seen it with whites.
That sort of begs the question, is there a reason you wouldn't want to use it with a red? Is there an aging issue? Is there a oxygen issue? I'm not sure.
Yeah, so I just wouldn't be prepared to say right now.
Yeah, I'm curious about that. So where you're at now, what are you looking to in the future for what you'd like to do? Do you envision becoming a winemaker yourself? What are your plans? What are you thinking about?
Well, currently I'm in Sonoma State's Wine MBA program. I just finished my first year, so I have a year and a half left, so it's been a lot of fun. And probably right after I finish, I'm going to look to either moving to another state or even another country. I've spent a little time in Rioja as well as South Africa, and those are two great up-and-coming wine regions, and those would be a lot of fun to go and visit and even learn about what they're doing. Just being 25, there's so much time and a lot of fun things to do. And learn about wine that way, because I grew up with it, but I didn't go to school for any of those things. I mean, the MBA is the first time when I was really, you know, geared towards learning about wine in that context. And even now, it's more about the business side of it. But I'm learning, you know, I was walking in the vineyards with our vineyard manager, Jim Del Bondio, who's been with our family since the 60s. He only left to go to Vietnam, and that was it.
Wow.
So, I mean, he's seen me, you know, from the time I was just toddling around.
Mm.
So he's always willing to share information with me, and he knows our land probably even better than my dad does. So at least, and being around doing compliance, because that way I'll see the wine from the moment it's brought in at harvest until it's bottled. So that's been an education just in itself. So it's a lot of fun because I've been learning so many different things and things that I wouldn't even know how to connect the dots. I've been able to that way.
So really, you know, you're just kind of bide your time, and once you get through your program, you know?
Hopefully, it would be a great thing to be a general manager of a winery one day, because I see that that would be something new. Women have taken so much charge of winemaking nowadays. It's great to see more women winemakers than there have been. But I think that there's still a lot of room for women to improve as GMs of wineries. For here, because a lot of places have been so machinery-oriented, in a lot of ways it's still so much more of the man's domain that way. But I think things are changing. People really have new attitudes. Look at South Africa. They have no problem whatsoever with so many women winemakers.
Kendall, if anybody'd like to learn about the Napa Wine Company or a little more about what Elizabeth Rose is, how would they find out about you?
Go to our website, which is www.elizabethrosewines.com. And even if you go to bondedwinery9.com, those will have all three labels. So if your palate wasn't necessarily suited towards Elizabeth Rose wines, there's the Ghost Block and Oakville Winery. So those are all cabs and zins, if those are more towards your style. Yeah, the tasting room is always open, so there's no appointment. You just come on in.
The tasting room, which is right on Highway 29, typical business hours for a tasting room around here?
Yes, 10 to 4:30, and each week we'll feature a different AP, so that's really fun if you were coming in two successive trips. You know, one week could be eponymous, another week could be William Nuttall, things like that. So each week we'll have new wines. But yeah, 10 to 4:30 and all the tasting room staff, so there's no appointment needed. So just stop on in.
Which is the best part, no appointment needed.
Yeah, and the best part is even you can go to Oakville Grocers afterwards, so you've got food and wine in the same spot.
It's a great place to eat.
Yes.
Kendall, this is great. This has been a lot of fun
getting
back together with you, and I wish you nothing but great success. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you very much. It's been fun.
Learn more about the Napa Wine Company on the web at napawineco.com. Thanks for listening to our October podcast. Watch for our next podcast, which was recorded during Crush at the GoldenEye Winery in Anderson Valley, featuring GoldenEye wines and Migration wines. Copyright 2011.